Welcome to the IF Podcast. I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. And joining me in Washington, D.C., I have four guests who are facilitators with the Interactivity Foundation, which is a nonprofit that creates forums for the public to discuss and explore public policy. Alton Turner, welcome.
Hi, Natalie. Thank you for having me.
Nicole Dillard.
Good morning.
Dan Cooper.
Hi, everyone.
And Allison Brown.
Hello.
There's so much going on in the news right now related to, you know, many of the public policy issues that we explore with the Interactivity Foundation and that we will be exploring in the many discussions that we're having primarily here in the Washington, D.C. area. We're going to get to the NAACP convention and the dueling speeches by the presidential candidates, as well as Jesse Jackson Jr. and his mysterious absence from Congress and what are some of the policy implications of that, as well as talk about some of the amazing new initiatives that this group of facilitators are going to be launching here in the Washington, D.C. area. We might have some discussions in Japan, in Virginia, and Spanish language discussions here in Washington, D.C. as well. Let's get started with Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. has not been in his office since June 10th, and it was a sort of a mystery about why he was gone and led to a whole lot of speculation about, you know, first the word was exhaustion that his staff put out. And that, of course, is a euphemism for so many things and usually related to rock stars.
In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital.
It's been more than a month since nine-term Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. left Capitol Hill under a cloud of mystery. Last night, Jackson's office released a statement from an unnamed doctor saying the Illinois Democrat is receiving intensive medical treatment at a residential treatment facility for a mood disorder.
One thought that occurs to me is that there's been a lot of snickering, you know, and a lot of finger quotes with his absence and his exhaustion.
One of the things that's probably causing the snickering, if I remember correctly, is I read something about there being having been an affair that occurred. And so, you know, we're not sure if the mood disorder has been slightly caused by what's going on at home. My mood would be altered too if I was getting hammered by my spouse every day about some illicit affair I've had. We should be becoming desensitized to even stories of affairs, because you're hearing that all the time. And I don't, and I think even though politics and morality often overlap to some degree, I feel like that concentric circle should be separating more and more as we go along, because apparently it's not so much a way of life, but these things happen. And it happens among politicians, it happens in private lives, and these things happen. So I feel as if maybe we should be becoming less concerned about people holding themselves on this moral high ground than actually worrying about just getting policy-related stuff done.
Right.
Yeah. I think Nicole is right. I think part of the snickering is just disbelief around the circumstances. You know, so first it was exhaustion. Then there were, you know, stories about this affair. And so I think people are just not fully believing that there's this mood disorder, and it hasn't been specified. And there are so many things that could be a mood disorder. Is it depression? Is it bipolar? Has he had it all along? There's just this mystery surrounding the whole thing. And I think there's just disbelief in the public. And then just an expectation that as a public figure and as a political figure in particular, you do kind of have an obligation to your constituents. So if you're going to disappear, you've got to explain your disappearance better than I think he has or his people have. So I think a lot of the laughter and the, you know, kind of snickering are less about the disorder itself, if it is a disorder, but more about kind of how he disappeared and why he disappeared and where he went and why, you know, there have been all of these excuses and none of them have really held true so far.
I think the laughter and snickering is related more to people just being frustrated with the whole political process. You know, you have one scandal after another, be it, you know, in the bathroom stall with kicking your feet over to the next stall, be it posting, you know, nude pictures of yourself on Facebook or on Twitter or whatever the case is. And now anytime someone says that they have a real issue, people always doubt what they're saying because, you know, everybody has an excuse for other behavior instead of just coming out what the issue is. If he really does have an issue, I have a mood disorder. But when it goes from, well, I have exhaustion and then I have a mood disorder, you know, it leaves people room to actually, you know, speculate as to what's really going on in your life.
Yeah, I should have mentioned he's also under investigation for ethical lapses related to related to the 2008 Governor Blagojevich had to appoint someone to replace Barack Obama in his Senate seat. And, you know, Jesse Jackson was one of the people with his hand up. And there were some allegations that some money changed hands and he was netted in that whole thing as well. So he's been feeling the pressure for a while. So, I mean, I could say, but what about if we set aside these other things, this other drama, which is impossible for people to do? Like, I'm trying to think of another example of when a member of Congress or even a politician said that they were dealing with mental illness. You know, there's such a stigma around it, and particularly in the Black community, but really for everyone.
I think it takes somebody to step out there and do it first. I mean, I think people will respect you more if you did that, just been upfront about it. And even within the Black community, I think there's, trying to remember the artist's name recently stepped out and said that he was bisexual.
Right, I mean, that's Frank Ocean.
Great example. Yeah. I mean, and I haven't heard this outcry, oh my God, Frank Ocean, you're bisexual. Damn you, Frank Ocean, we hate you. I haven't heard that. So, I mean, I think it just takes the courage to step out there and, you know, be who you are. And that's, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. People respect that.
But political power at what price? At one point, you have to think, do I want my representative as a constituent to maybe be diagnosed with a mood disorder or be bipolar or perhaps grapple with even alcoholism? That's part of the speculation. So if he's dealing with all of these issues and he still wants to go back and try for re-election, at some point we have to say, hey, why are we beholden to Jesse Jackson Jr.? Shouldn't he get his life together, then maybe come back and then be my representative?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, this is Alton. That's a good point, actually, but I think people like to see some frailties in their representatives, and to make you a real person. When you put yourself on these pedestals, that's when you fall harder. I think if people were just honest about who they were and what they were about, I think people would be much more accepting. And I think that's part of the problem with the political discourse now. Everybody is smoke and mirrors. No one's really telling the American public, you know, be it in the Black community or whatever, the community at large, what they really think or believe.
I'm still having a hard time with this because this Congress has done the least amount in many, many, many years. And since we've been recording the actual laws passed in sessions, and to take another person out of the fray, we're not really getting much done. How much does Jesse Jackson Jr. have to focus on?
Another thing, Dan, that has actually his office pointed out, or maybe some of his supporters pointed out, was that people gave Gabrielle Giffords time to heal, and they were very understanding. Like, when you have something like you've been shot, there is a difference in people's mind about whether you have a mental illness or whether you have sort of a physical illness. And I'm wondering, should there be that distinction there? I mean, should you give people more support?
Natalie, I think, and this is Allison, I think that Representative Giffords was shot, and we knew that right away. Again, we're not really sure what is going on with Representative Jackson, and we've not really heard a story. We've seen this statement from a doctor who's not identified. That doctor's not spoken. So I don't think that there is this difference in the way that we treat physical ailments versus mental illness in this circumstance. Now, I think, you know, generally as a society, absolutely. And this is why, you know, Congress had to legislate for the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and other things to protect students with disabilities that were kind of less clear than the things that are kind of physical barriers for students in schools. But I don't think that this scenario is that necessarily.
I think the thing with Representative Giffords is that her entire journey has been chronicled. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw pictures of her in the hospital. We saw every stage of accomplishment that she's made, you know, even setbacks. You know, we saw everything. And I think one of the problems with Representative Jackson's problem is that we have been getting these random cryptic messages.
Very vague
of what's wrong with him. Obviously, he's been a representative for a while, so we've never heard of any kind of issue or even seen evidence of it. So it's not like, oh, well, he kind of goes off on his staff and that may sort of reflect maybe a bipolar, you know, tendencies. And then his old staff members to say, that's what's wrong with him, because I know when I worked back for him in whatever 19, whatever, he was doing this. There's been none of that. It's just sort of evolved. Now, I realize that mental health issues can evolve and they can kind of present themselves later on in life. So I'm not trying to discredit the possibility of that. But I think that it's sort of contributing to the snickering, and you hear all of these other outside things contributing to it. You know, it makes you just kind of wonder if this is just more sort of smoke and mirrors to sort of cover up another issue, like you know what? I'm just having a hard time at home right now. Or, you know what? I'm at that point in my career where things are coming at, you know, 25 directions between the ethical investigation and, yeah, I've been drinking a little bit too much to deal with the fact I got to stop the noise going on at home and whatever, you know, yeah, because that's just how life goes.
I agree, Nicole. And how much of that could be used as an excuse at the end of the day, you know, because your mental disorder, whatever that might be, could be an impetus for saying, hey, well, you know, I'm addicted to sex.
How about you just had an affair? I mean, you know, I don't know, I have issues with the whole addicted to sex thing. No, could, you just had an affair. You just couldn't.
It could be used, though. It could be used.
Yeah.
It's possible.
I think
Nicole and Dan make a good point. And, you know, I think there is a general cynicism around politicians, you know, these days. And thinking about the ethical implications and his involvement with Blagojevich and others and the kind of replacement of Obama's seat and all of that, you know, I mean, I think he would certainly want to go hide for some weeks and, you know, get his mind right or something. I think, you know, looking at D.C. right now and what's happening with, you know, politicians in this city and black politicians in particular, you know, I think Vince Gray would love to crawl under a rock right now and, you know, claim a mood disorder or something like that. So I think there's just kind of a general cynicism around just kind of what politicians are up to and what their motives are.
This is Alton. I mean, I think that's kind of the point, though. If they'd be honest about things, I think people would be a lot more accepting. I think, you know, Marion Barry is a prime example of that. I can't even count how many times he's gotten second chances mm-hmm. over the years, be it tax issues, be it, you know, getting caught in a room with a prostitute with cocaine on hand. I mean, that would kill most other politicians. But for whatever reason, Barry's been able to come back over the years from this stuff. And,
he's
you know.
Phoenix.
He's
now,
a Phoenix.
Now, it's because Chocolate City, we're trendsetters. We're much more understanding of mental health issues, and we're much more, you know, understanding and compassionate about these things.
But I think even, this is often again, I think even like Anthony Weiner, if he had been honest about what his situation was, I made a mistake, I'm sorry, it's between me and my wife, I'm going to work it out. He'd have been okay. But when you lie, and you continue to lie, to cover up the first lie, people lose faith in you, lose credibility, and then you have to be walked out the door.
And, you know, maybe it could be that Jesse Jackson Jr. isn't the best person. Like, he's not the Frank Ocean of mental health. I mean, you have public figures like Betty Ford, who really did a lot to reduce the stigma around alcoholism. And I think there needs to be a similar, you know, brave figure that can come forward on the mental health issue. I know Bassey Kipsey is a performance poet who has started this whole Twitter and Facebook campaign called No Shame, with the hashtag No Shame. And actually had some friends who participated in that, where they disclosed their mental illness and they put it on Twitter. And she was sort of targeting the black community in particular. She even had t-shirts that I'm bipolar. I don't know how I feel about it, but in general, I feel good. Anything that sort of, you know, takes away some of these stigmas and, you know, for a public figure in Congress to do something like that, I think could advance, but maybe not someone with as much baggage as Jesse yes. Jr. has. Right.
But do you think, and this is Nicole, I'm sorry, Dan, do you think that in terms of putting it out there, I think I'm sure some people's attitudes are probably, you know, if I had a, you know, disorder, but you could look at me and say, I never would have known. Well, because I manage it well, you know, mm-hmm. or someone who's got something like, if you think about a person who's got dyslexia and you would never know because maybe they're this great, I don't know, they're a great writer or they're great, and they're like, yeah, well, I've learned how to compensate. I've learned mm-hmm. how to, you know, manage the issue. And yeah, I've had to overcome these challenges I have. So I'm sure the attitude, I'm sure there are many, I mean, many, but I'm sure there are other people in Congress who probably have some sort of mental illness somewhere, just because that's such a broad characterization of illnesses. But if they manage it, then it's like, well, it's none of your business. Unless it interferes with my day-to-day, that's when you should know. I'm thinking that's probably what's happening. But does that make them feel shamed?
Yeah.
Like, that's the issue. Like, are they shamed by it? Or is it just a matter of, you don't need to know this about me any more than you need to know my shoe size?
Right.
Or any more than any other, like, if I got strep throat last week, you know, or something like that.
And that's where I don't know where the line is, but we're sort of entering new territory with this Twitter campaign that Bassey Kipsey did. And, you know, just sort of a plug for one of the IF reports, there's a report edited by Adolf Gunderson called Healthcare, the Case of Depression. You know, he's looking at healthcare, but depression in particular, and, you know, some of the possibilities that his group of panelists came up with. They talked about in social interaction and community support, and, you know, having a more holistic approach to, like, how we're dealing with these mental health issues. So, you know, there'll be an IF discussion at some point that could sort of explore some of these issues. Now, I did want to transition to looking at the NAACP convention this week, and we had a couple of speeches that were talked about quite a bit. First, Mitt Romney, the GOP presidential candidate, came to address the convention. And then Joe Biden came to address the convention as well. And, you know, it was sort of an interesting contrast and approaches to, you know, looking at, you know, this is the oldest civil rights organization. And a lot of talk was about when Romney was sort of rattling off the things that he intended to do, he mentioned that he was going to repeal Obamacare, at which point they booed him like they were at Showtime at the Apollo. And at the end of his speech, he did get a standing ovation.
If our goal is jobs, we have to stop spending over $1 trillion more than we take in every year. And so to do that, I'm going to eliminate every non-essential, expensive program I can find. That includes Obamacare. And I'm going to work to reform and save.
Lots of things there. I mean, some people felt like it was inappropriate for the NAACP convention goers to boo their guests in their home. You know, other people felt like it was a whole cynical play by Romney that he actually wanted them to be booed so that he has that clip to show his base that look at that.
This is Daniel. My first thought was that, yes, I probably would have had the uncontrollable urge to boo, no matter what he said, because I'm pretty much against Mitt Romney at this point.
That's your party, though.
It is my party, but I've made up my mind that Mitt is definitely, he's going down a road, and especially his quote that he's going to somehow help the African-American community more so than Barack was so completely ludicrous that I felt like he was baiting the crowd. So I probably would have booed. Now, with that being said, how much ammunition is he going to get out of this? Only by saying that he has been consistent in his inconsistencies, pretty much. I just feel like his whole purpose for being there was probably not met.
Dan, this is Allison. You'll be shocked to know that I disagree with you slightly. I don't think Romney was talking to that audience. And I don't think that he really believed that he would get up there and they would support everything that he had to say and they'd clap and it would be polite. And I do kind of take this cynical view that he was speaking to his supporters and he was really trying to convince those who are not quite trusting of him and his message that he's going to be consistent. Finally, he's decided to be consistent on this message of conservatism, and he's taking that message despite the pressures that are put on him and despite, you know, a hostile audience. He's going to take that message across America so that he can better, you know, circumstances for the country. So I disagree that he got up there expecting to be supported in his message. I don't think he could, or any of his handlers could have believed that he could stand up there and say that he would do a better job for the black community than the black president has done. Or
first
would
time
do.
President, too.
Clinton doesn't count?
No. Nah, okay. Definitely.
On Sundays only.
Check it.
So I disagree with Toni Morrison on that also.
Allison, I have to agree with you on that. I think, you know, from my estimation of Mitt Romney, he's, over the years, watching presidential campaigns, probably the biggest opportunist there is. And it actually would bother me if I were him to try to bring my father into the fold, who was a very principled man. When I read about him, you know, in terms of civil rights movement and his actions up in Michigan when he was up there as a politician, I just haven't seen someone just as open to, you know, making things up or changing their stories or changing their positions on the whim. And, you know, to go in to the NAACP convention and expect that, you know, group of black people who like to be talked to very directly and very plainly and tell them that, you know, we're going to take away Obamacare, which is the principal.
It's Romney Care, even.
It's Romney Care. Right. You know, especially when you brought it up in Massachusetts. You're going to take
he
that away.
He invented it, yes.
Yeah, you're going to take it away. I mean, you just have no credibility. And to expect not to get booed is just ridiculous. But I would agree that that's what he did it for, you know, to go to his base and say, look, this is the response I get from Obama supporters. I need you to support me now. This is what they do to me. I need you to get out there in the streets and help me campaign against this type of nonsense. I need you to go out there and raise money for me. And I think that's going to be an effective tool for him over the course of the campaign to try to, you know, create more division to win the election. I think you have the basis, the 40-40, and then it's in the middle of the 20 that we have to worry about in terms of how the election is going to go. And that's going to be one of his tools.
I feel like he was definitely trying to bait the audience, and he definitely wanted to have the response of vitriol, but I don't think that he got the response that he wanted. It wasn't enough vitriol, actually. politely booing and sitting down is not enough ammunition, what he needs. He needs real hatred to come to the surface in order for this to work.
Right.
He needs more than a shoe. He needs tomatoes. And,
the hook. You know, back to the Apollo, he needs a hook.
He needs a hook of some kind. He needs real vitriol to condense his base and mobilize them against, you know, the terrible people that want universal health care. Right. Imagine that.
It was interesting. I saw something on one of the news channels, and they said, you know, this is not about Obama. This is about your mama or something, talking about Obamacare, but how the Health Care Reform Act is supposed to be, you know, appealing to, you know, the elderly and things like that, people who are getting, who are not able to get health insurance because of, you're laughing. You like that?
Obama, not about your mama.
About Obama, it's about your mama. But, you know, people who can't get it because of pre-existing conditions. Thank you. I'm losing my words right now. But it is interesting because I know, as Natalie, you and I have talked about, it's about the messaging. And so maybe he will use this as, Romney will use this as part of his messaging about getting Obamacare overturned. I mean, obviously the House just voted on it. It probably won't be successful in the Senate. Right. The House just voted on it again. Probably will not be successful in the Senate again. But now, obviously, in that article, I think Obama was actually talking about, or in another article I read, Obama was actually saying, he actually admitted that one of his biggest problems over the past couple of years have been messaging. And he said, you know, I thought that, you know, it was about getting there and doing a good job and getting policies through and getting work done. He said, but I forgot about the messaging piece. So given the next 4 years, what I hope to do is get my message out more and inspire. He was more so talking about, I spent my entire time as a candidate inspiring people, getting out messages. And I've actually put that on the back burner and sort of kind of put my head down and got to work. Mm-hmm. But now he realizes that in his next term, if he's given that opportunity, that he needs to do better about the messaging, which is something we've talked about, even about, you know, with this Health Care Reform Act, is about the messaging, because people don't really understand in its plainest, you know, form what this Health Care Reform Act, they're just kind of seeing it as you're trying to make us pay for health care and we don't really want to, or taxpayers are forced to do XYZ. But I think it's the messaging that's been lost. And to Romney's point, well, to all of you all's point, I think what's happening is he may use this in one way or another as a way to get his messaging out, whatever that message may be, either to repeal Obamacare or to get his supporters on his side to try to sort of fuel the base.
This is all, well, two things. I mean, I do fault Obama for, you know, to your point, not getting correct message out. I mean, that's the biggest part about it in any political discussion you want to have, to get your message out. And I think the NAACP could be used part of that process. If, you know, the biggest national black organization in the country, they should have been a partner with Obama in terms of spreading the word about Obamacare and what it means to everyday ordinary citizens, especially black citizens, you know, who don't have health care, who are, you know, a large constituency that would be benefited by Obamacare. And he did a terrible job of that. I mean, I think that goes along the way of not just healthcare, but, you know, the economic reforms as well. The Republicans do an excellent job of packaging the message. And if you don't actually get out there and frame your message, they'll do it for you. And, you know, be it the job killing, whatever, they will put the message out there for you. And it's kind of interesting that Romney can get on the stage and say, this is job killing, this is this and this, and when he actually did the same thing in his home state of Massachusetts. And it's, and, you know, the fact that we don't call him on that is amazing to me. Instead of booing, actually, I would prefer people to say, oh, I have a question for you. Didn't you do this in your state? And why is it bad now? Tell me specifically why you think it's bad. And, you know, instead of being such reactionary groups that black people are seen as, I mean, it'd be fairly interesting to just sit there and have a conversation. There's some intelligent people in that room, I imagine, and say, break this down for me. Why do you believe that is the case?
I'm sorry. This is Daniel. I feel like he, you know, as a black Republican, I'm here to tell you that, you know, it is possible to be a Republican, but it is also possible to be a bad Republican. And he is.
Who was your candidate this year?
Barack Obama.
No, I mean, in the GOP side.
I had to politely abstain from this primary election. I had no intention of voting for anybody that was out there, honestly, in a national election. So I just don't think it's interesting.
He was the closest, though.
You mentioned the point earlier. It wouldn't be an interesting discussion because he would waffle again. That's what he does.
But I think it'd be interesting to get it on the record where he stood. So regardless of what his position is, you approve this in your state. Why is it bad now for everyone else? And if it is bad, tell me specifically what you want to do.
Right.
Don't give me generalities. Don't give me, well, I'm going to get a black grant to the state. How's that going to work and how's that going to benefit my community? How about, you know, even if you can't answer it right now, how about you go back to wherever you live and wherever you work and tell your people to get together and give me a position piece on this. Send it back to me so I can actually take a look at it and we can have a conversation later on about this. We'll bring it back after we read your position piece. And then as a block, you know, 10% of this population, we can tell our constituency what you're about. And if you're serious and you're genuine about being here, about supporting the black community.
He's not. He's not genuine.
Okay, but that's how you put people on the record. That's how you call people wow.
The idea of a position paper is amazing because, I mean, Romney's a bit of a, I mean, he's a bit of a mystery because we really don't know what he wants to do. And so, yeah, I'm just thinking, as Nicole was talking about Obama spending his early part of his career inspiring people and getting the messaging right and firing people up and then actually closing the door and getting to work. A lot of what we're engaged with the Interactivity Foundation is having opportunities for people to sit around and actually talk about the policies. And because the politics, it tends to take over all of that. But actually in this IF report, Future Possibilities for Civil Rights pretty neatly shows the level of contrast that they're in. The first two possibilities probably fall more in the Romney camp where you're talking about your money or your rights is a possibility and the government is making more promises that it can keep and that we need to think about the costs and basis for adding new rights. And also, you know, this idea of distinguishing rights by your citizen status. If you're a native born American, you have some rights. And the other side, you know, is looking at an expansion of rights. You know, we want to include more people who weren't necessarily born here. We want to include protections, you know, to cover sexual orientation and all these other sort of things. So finish the basement is the contrasting approach that's it's in this report, which, you know, we'll also be discussing at a IF discussion near you. You know, I was going to talk about Biden, but I don't think we need to.
Except for the fact that Biden's speech actually did sort of promote messaging. I think he was sort of informally trying to foster that partnership and saying, hey, you guys get out there, get the word out, you know, work with us, support us, explain reasons essentially why you need to support us and not them.
Yeah. And he also said, you know, speaking to people like Daniel, this is not your father's Republican Party. You know, mm-hmm. I think that was one of the main sound bites that Biden said when he was speaking. Mm-hmm. And because there were a lot of black Republicans at once upon a time, it was sort of a different party at that point.
People believed in the two-party system.
But also on that point too, I mean, I think it's important to know that Biden came there with the expectation that it's just business as usual, that the black voter in NAACP is going to support him directly.
Right.
And I'm beginning to have more and more of a problem with that, even despite the fact we have a black president. You know, what are politicians doing for black community? And, you know, you have the Hispanic community or the other communities across this country who demand things from politicians based upon, you know, their support. And we just give it away like, okay, well, thank you for coming, boss. We appreciate it.
Or you actually, boss doesn't even have to come.
More than any other office in the land, the presidency is about character, the character of your convictions. Whether you put country above politics. From the very moment that Barack Obama took his hand off that Bible on that cold January day in the mall, he's done just that. He has put country first.
Right, because Obama did not come. Yes, he did not. He sent a video. He had other plans.
I will say that I think the black community has certainly been trying to get in to the White House, Alton, you know, to your point. And I think they've been stonewalled, to tell you the truth. You know, I mean, I think they really have made desperate attempts to sit down and discuss the needs in the community and to really get someone who's dedicated to making sure that, you know, this message about healthcare is out there in the black community and education issues are addressed in the black community and et cetera. And I think that they've met with some resistance on that. So
from the White House, you're saying?
From the White House, right.
I think this is just a really unenviable position on the part of Barack Obama being the first black president because he can't appear to placate to his constituency, people who look like him. And that played out in the whole Trayvon Martin situation.
I think he can, though. I think he can, and
in
he should.
In the second term, he can.
And, well,
I'll give you an example. I mean, because the status quo is a white guy in the office, and the majority of this country is white. So you're not placating to a certain base when you come from that background. Whereas if you're the first black guy, And a lot of support that got you there was from minorities across the country, mainly a lot of black people. I think 90% of the black vote went to Obama. You know, he would be, you know, pulled out and called out big time if he started implementing programs specifically to take care of black folks. As a contrast that to a George Bush, who took care of his oil buddies when he got in office and said, okay, well, you know, we're going to have tax credits for oil companies. We don't need them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a distinction, I think.
We've tipped the scales now. We're past 2012 threshold where minority births have outnumbered white American births here in the United States. So is it really a minority that he's placating?
But they're not voters yet.
Not yet, but
well, and
most
it's left
people.
Him in an awkward position because now he's left with supporters who are lethargic. They're not out there the way they were, you know, in 2008 to support him. And he's really trying to galvanize them now after having ignored large parts of them for the past 3 years. So
he keeps annoying me with emails. I get emails.
And he's so aggravated. Yeah, and he's desperate because he's being so outspent by this Romney campaign, which came out and did, you know, did its messaging at the NAACP with, you know, this hostile group, and I would love to see how much he raised on that day.
Okay, well, the last topic, I'd just like to sort of throw it open. You know, we're all facilitators around the table. If you could talk a little bit about some of the initiatives you guys have coming up, some of the topics that you plan to explore. Really excited if we've translated a number of the policy discussion guides into Spanish now. And so, Alice, could you talk a little bit about your plans?
Sure. My children attend a Spanish immersion charter school here in Washington, D.C., and the school has agreed to open its doors and allow IF to come in and do a facilitated discussion in Spanish. The school is 50% native Spanish speakers, 50% native English speakers. We're going to start with the food report to discuss the IF food report in their native language. The native English speakers will have an opportunity to practice their Spanish and to model for their children, you know, the acceptance of the language and, you know, attempt to really try to communicate with one another in Spanish over good food, about food, and bring the community together.
I've done one already on retirement. Actually, it was a pretty interesting conversation and had a cross-section of people, older, younger. They're all lawyers, but younger lawyers versus older lawyers, I'll put it like that. And just, the differences in opinion were pretty interesting. But I think some of the common thread that we saw there was that, based upon the conversation we were having today, there's such a discord in this country in terms of, you know, how people, see the world and just how they view politicians, how they view policies that are being implemented right now. And it's leading to a sense of, you know, dysfunctional isn't the word I'm looking for. I'm looking for just there's no cohesiveness in this country. There's no, well, you can be a Republican, I can be a Democrat, and we should come together on these, like you said, two-party system. Come together on these issues and sort it out. Regardless if I disagree with you, we'll fight it out today, you know, we'll go to lunch tomorrow. And I think that's what's being lost here amongst all these different discussions. I was planning on doing stuff on civil rights and energy as well. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, along the same lines. I mean, you talk about energy policy. Why don't we have an energy policy in this country? It is broken up among Democrats versus Republicans. Republicans are pro-energy. Democrats are pro-green power or whatever you want to call it. And there's just no cohesiveness in that sense. So it's hard to actually come up with policies. And I think these are important discussions because I don't think people think about when you say energy policy or civil rights or retirement, people look at the larger issues, who we are as a country, where we're going as a country. And I think we've lost a lot of that over the past, I guess, 20 years. You know, everything has just gone, you know, downhill, from my opinion, at least. And, you know, that's what I kind of picked up on during my conversation. But I think that's a common thread through all the conversations we'll have at IF, you know, where are we going as a country? What do we believe in? And do people think critically enough about these issues to actually have an opinion about it? And actually, you know, when they hear a politician say something, they say something, you know, think critically about it and say, you're right, you're wrong, or, you know, we have room for discussion here.
This is Daniel. I hope to have the first IF discussion in Japan. And I want to do that probably with a lot of expatriates on either energy or education because it's very popular. Mm-hmm. So my plan is to next week gather around as many embassy folks as I can.
I don't know that it would be the first because there was a fellow who just came back from Japan. They did a tour of East Asia and actually we did a podcast on them as well.
Oh.
I don't know how many discussions she was able to do. Right. Maybe the second.
Or the third.
But it'll be fantastic to be able to do that. I mean, they have a lot of energy issues over there in Japan, obviously.
Obviously, yeah. They have, you know, Fukushima being the biggest issue they have right now. And also they're protesting in the streets. It'd be interesting to get an American's perspective on what's happening right now.
It's going to be the first bison salon.
That's it would be the first bison salon in Japan.
True.
I don't know if I can find that many bison in Japan, but we're everywhere.
That's right.
Probably could.
Nicole?
I plan on doing a discussion on education in the Virginia Beach area of Virginia. And we'll be assembling a group of educators, older educators, younger educators, parents who just have a general, obviously, interest in education in the system, really just to facilitate a broader discussion, especially as, unlike DC, which has a lot of charter schools and, you know, you have public, private, and charter school options, Virginia is usually more limited. It's either public school option or private. They don't have many charter school options, and certainly not in the Virginia Beach, Norfolk, Hampton Roads area, that option's not there. So the majority of the kids, if you don't go to a private school, which isn't as common as, say, you would be up here where kids go to a lot of private schools. They're in the public school system. You know, there's urban school system down there with the Norfolk area. Virginia Beach is seen more as suburban and very, very large. There are probably about 12 or 13 public high schools in the Virginia Beach area alone. So I'm going to be assembling a number of educators and other interested parties and talk about the education.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Allison Brown.
Thanks for
coming.
Having me.
Daniel Cooper.
Thank you for having me.
Nicole Dillard.
Thank you.
And Alton Turner.
Thank you for having me.
All facilitators with the Interactivity Foundation. And if you're interested in participating in some of the discussions they'll be having, the live discussions that we'll be having, you can email us at ifpodcast@gmail.com. This has been the IF Podcast. I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. Thanks for joining us.